you very much. That was very kind. I've been to a lot of bioethics meetings, and I have to say this morning was more fun than 99% of the meetings I've attended. And so I'd like to thank everybody who spoke this morning for that interesting as well as entertaining a few hours. But it does put me in mind of other meetings I've attended, and I'd like to take you back to the late 1990s to a meeting that concerned cloning at a time when cloning was about Dolly and not about stem cells. And it was an ancillary meeting to the International Association of Bioethics meeting in Tokyo, and it was a gathering of representatives of various national bioethics advisory committees from across the globe and across all the continents. One of the things that immediately came into the discussion because of the excitement about cloning for reproductive purposes was an inquiry as to whether there could be a nice, easy consensus statement about how terrible reproductive cloning is that would represent a kind of global attitude and a harmonization of national policies to be subsequently implemented with domestic legislation. And the conversation went along very predictable lines. Everybody thought that cloning for reproductive purposes, in addition to being manifestly unsafe, was probably either gratuitous, egotistical, or simply silly, and therefore was simply just a distasteful way of thinking about human reproduction. Of course, there were the predictable bows in the direction of personal autonomy and reproductive decision-making that were also part of the conversation. The consensus that reproductive cloning was kind of silly and distasteful was reached rather rapidly. But proposals to harmonize national policies were much more troublesome, because while many countries had the unfettered power to simply legislate based upon the fact that an idea was silly or distasteful, in places like the United States, we ran up against the fact that we had a political and legal structure that specifically forbids the government, in some circumstances, from legislating on a basis that lacks nothing, that has nothing more to it than the fact that something is distasteful and silly. In addition, we had structures like the federalist system, in which we have state jurisdiction as opposed to national jurisdiction, which also complicated the ways in which the U.S. could approach this when it came to implementing any kind of consensus statement. And this was the first time I really found myself wondering whether our debates in bioethics and our often cited goal of harmonizing national policies would depend, in many cases, far less upon a consensus about the technology's individual merits and would depend more on whether or not the relevant national, legal, and political cultures themselves could be harmonized, and indeed whether or not they ought to be harmonized. I also found myself wondering, in the context specifically of bioethics and public policy, the kind of bioethics that's done on National Academy committees or the President's Council on Bioethics or an NIH specialty panel looking at genetic testing or human embryo research, wondering if the way to craft the public policy advice in the area of bioethics might be better off not starting, as it almost always does, with a deep analysis of the individual technologies and their merits and their demerits, and instead start with an analysis of the relevant national, political, and legal culture and the historical setting and the political swirls at the moment that one faces, and only then begin to talk about the technologies and their merits against this background set of presumptions about what can and cannot, ought and ought not be done by the government at this time. In other words, is it possible, I wondered, whether sweeping political forces, historical, cultural, structural, and legal, may be the most important parts of the bioethics debate and may at times even overdetermine the outcome of the specific policy debates in which we engage. I wasn't trying to suggest that the analysis of the parental duty of care toward children or the personal right to refuse unwanted medical care is necessarily pointless or unimportant. Simply that these kinds of analyses don't necessarily justify what we ought to do or explain why we're going to pick certain policies over another. Furthermore, while I'm not suggesting that these areas of more traditional bioethics analysis are irrelevant, I would suggest that they are not an ideal, because from my perspective, having worked on public policy, politics is not merely an irritating constraint that prevents us from enacting what is the best public policy based upon a pure philosophical or theological analysis, But politics is, in fact, an embodiment of a set of values more often discussed in the political philosophy literature than the moral philosophy literature, a set of values about the appropriate role of government and the governance of society. That's what led me to think that we need to pay much more attention, more often, not as a critique, but as part of the very essence of the analysis, to the unique histories that yield unique phenomena that help explain what goes on in bioethics. We all know that the anti-biotechnology and anti-euthanasia forces are particularly robust in Germany, and we all understand that it makes sense in the context of the Nazi political party and the mid-20th century experiments in eugenics. Just last night, Stuart Younger was talking to me about his experiences in Eastern Europe and how in Romania their abortion policies are driven largely by a reaction to the excesses of the pro-natalist Ceausescu regime, whereas in Poland, their anti-abortion stance is influenced strongly by the role of the church in helping to overthrow the communist government. So that again, the analysis of the role of abortion or reproductive rights in these countries makes little sense without really starting from a position of historical context. Other factors may be more subtle. The United States does not have a universal health care system, as we've heard. One of the effects of this is that, in contrast to countries that do, where doctors become part of the governing elite, part of the group that is rationing and making decisions about what is or is not medical care, in the United States, physicians become allies with their patients in a consumerist approach to medicine because they are not part of the governing, rationing world of medicine, but instead are a set of individual actors all working with an individual patient. The absence of universal health care also creates a set of background inequities, inequities that also exist due to poverty and differential educational levels, inequities that then form an unequal backdrop that makes the analysis of any technology extremely difficult in the United States. Those who worry that the advent of genetic testing or genetic therapies will wind up exacerbating inequities are certainly doing this analysis based on the fact that they're assuming those inequities are there and we have to worry about whether they will be exacerbated. While those who want to focus on the technology in and of itself fear that we're trying to cure the problem of background inequities on the backs of a single technology, whether it's genetic testing or stem cell therapy. And both positions have merit, but neither position can be resolved until we accept the reality that we have to understand how we're going to do ethical analysis against the backdrop of inequity, as opposed to a pure ethical analysis that assumes some idealized system of idealized autonomous rational actors behind the scenes. Another specifically American phenomenon is a rather tortured state of the American women's movement, which from my perspective has forever been torn between viewing women as subject as victims or potential victims of the state, of patriarchy, and of the medical community based on a long 20th century history of documented excesses, versus another portion of the movement that prefers to view women as rational, autonomous beings whose victimization is similar to that of other people who suffer from educational or economic deficits. Both these wings of the movement tend to approach technological innovation very differently and come to very different conclusions about whether or not individual choice in the context of genetic testing or sex selection or gene therapy makes sense and accounts in part for the deafening silence of the women's movement on many of these current topics. Structural forces also include things like our electoral system, which is representative instead of parliamentary. Imagine, for example, if we did not have members of Congress who had to fear the five-second ad spot in their next election cycle that says, he voted to kill Terri Schiavo. He voted to kill patients who need stem cell therapy. The excesses of the positions that are taken are driven in part by the very nature of the electoral system that we have chosen in the United States, as opposed to the more party-disciplined system, more ideological system of the European political parliamentary systems. In addition, our primaries make the presidential elections just as vulnerable as the local congressional elections. Primaries, as we all know, drive candidates to the extremes in order to secure their base and achieve a plurality, and thus tend to result in either extremist candidates, or if you get a moderate, somebody who's so milquetoast that nobody can actually bear to vote for him. All of these things, I would suggest, are as relevant in the analysis of what is good bioethics public policy as is an analysis that is grounded in either consequentialist or deontological analysis of the individual merits of the technology. One of the most important differences I'd like to note about the U.S. versus other countries is the existence of the Bill of Rights. Bill of Rights sets American jurisprudence and bioethics public policy debates apart from virtually every other country. Because even when there are perfectly good reasons for restricting a technology or even to call for its prohibition entirely, the Bill of Rights and its penumbra give individuals a claim that at least in certain areas of fundamental rights, restrictions must meet a much stricter test for governmental justification. The result is a legal system that specifically favors the individual over the collective, the dissenter over the majority, the eccentric over the conformist, and at least with respect to things like free speech and reproductive choice, the future over the present. That is, it favors intergenerational justice and the assurance of a peaceful form of regime change over intragenerational concerns such as the most efficient or popular legal ordering for the moment. And in 2003, the Supreme Court, in the case of Lawrence versus Texas, which had to do with anal sex in Texas, and for those of you from the Republic of Texas, I'd like to thank you for the case. The Supreme Court wrote in an opinion penned by Justice Kennedy that a state's governing majority, declaring that the fact that a state's governing majority has traditionally viewed a particular practice as immoral is not a sufficient reason for upholding a law prohibiting the practice. Now think about how profound a statement that is. It says that it essentially denies the very existence of a legitimate role of the government in directing purely personal, intimate behaviors on the basis of prevalent moral codes. And what's very, very interesting is that it says this without also claiming that the underlying behavior was protected by fundamental rights. That is, it didn't base it on the need for a higher justification of the government. It said there is no legitimate role of government in regulating personal morality outside of the need to protect identifiable, vulnerable parties. Wow. If that were followed, and it has not yet been, and many people would suggest in the current court that it's not likely to, but if that were followed in case law and in political philosophy, it would represent a profound differentiation between the U.S. approach and the approach of many other countries to the regulation of the personal choices that are often facilitated, made possible for the first time by the advent of new technologies. Now, at a still deeper level, it seems to me that the solutions to our bioethics dilemmas are often answered by reference to political philosophy as well as raw politics. And here it's where I think that the Kennedy comment reflects a real pre- and post-Enlightenment debate over moral relativism. That his cry for governmental restraint in morals regulation represents one of the many values that were associated with the Enlightenment in Europe. Fundamental differences in political approach, logic versus faith in reasoning, optimism versus pessimism regarding the improvability, as opposed not the perfectibility, but improvability of the human condition, and embracing versus resisting the serendipitous changes in society that are wrought by economics, technology, and science. Now, from my perspective, the conservative bioethics movement knows this and for many years has been creating a set of interlocking boards, journals, commissions, and think tanks that have looked to identify a consistent political and articulate a consistent political philosophy that rejects these approaches and that would undergird a specific series of bioethics analyses ranging from assisted suicide to stem cell research. And that this has been a very conscious choice in terms of funding and staffing. In March of 2005, the Washington Post had an article that repeated a memorandum that came from the then chair of the President's Council on Bioethics, Leah Katz, in which he wrote that it was now time for a conservative bioethics agenda that was broader and more ambitious than the ongoing congressional efforts. Because, quote, we have today an administration and a Congress as friendly to human life and human dignity as we are likely to have for many years to come. This followed on statements in the inaugural issue of the New Atlantis Journal by Yuval Levin, who had been the executive director of the council under Bush, in which he called for a transformation of technological angst and fear into a conservative bioethics agenda associated with regulation and prohibition of specific technologies. Now, as an intellectual movement, bioethics is constantly transforming itself. It belonged to the theologians. It was snatched away by the secular philosophers. It was infused, it was overwhelmed and swallowed up by the physicians and the lawyers, and then finally infused with the humanists in the 1990s. Our current phase seems to be Balkanization. One of the comments in our session on politicization this morning, I forget if it was the plenary or the special, had to do with whether or not we should just have balkanized medical communities. The Christian Medical Association, which never prescribes contraception or the morning after pill, and the the libertarian medical community that will give you cosmetic surgery even if your nose is perfectly fine, and all phases and in between. Well, bioethics, to some extent, I do think has been balkanized into liberal and conservative wings. It is partly because it has come into its own as a public policy player, but I'd suggest it's also because people have come to recognize more and more frequently the deeper political philosophies that are driving their analyses, but that have rarely been discussed as vividly as they should in the bioethics debates. And we certainly have become players. The Bioethics Defense Fund, for example, offers white papers, policy briefings, and legal briefs on any human life issue. And its board includes the founder of the Beckett Fund, which is devoted to promoting school prayer and government support for religious schools. I mean, there is a kind of pattern of interlocking boards, which has been documented in articles I've written, that Catherine Hinch has published, the Women's Bioethics Project, and others. The liberals and progressives in the bioethics movement, I would like to say, have a similarly interlocking set of staffs and boards and journals, but the fact is they don't. As is typical of my experience as a Fulbright scholar at the University of Paris, when they split the Sorbonne into two faculties, the right wing, Paris 2, was very organized, and the left wing, Paris 1, was a disaster zone. I was teaching at Paris 1. The ideas that I think link people in the neoconservative and conservative, and I'm using them interchangeably, but there are, of course, significant differences. The idea is linking these people and institutions, from my observation point, is more than just a shared dark vision of science and a fear of the social change that's wrought by technological innovation. I also think it is a shared belief in the permissibility, in fact, sometimes the imperative, of governmentally enforced morals regulation, whether it's about the parental choice whether to embrace or avoid the birth of a child with genetic disorder, or the individual choice to hasten or delay death, or the intimate choice of two people of the same sex to marry or not. There is a basic divide between those who would call for pure majoritarian governance, often based on majoritarian views that are founded on majoritarian religious ethos, and those who would instead argue for a reticence on the part of the government to interfere except under stringently justified circumstances. And it's this kind of divide that strikes me as being relevant to the world of bioethics and public policy, one that takes in issues around moral relativism and moral pluralism. We heard yesterday about Manichaeanism and the determined kind of trend among neoconservatives to identify moral absolutes. And, of course, to the very complex arguments about the increased permeation of religion into public policy, which is not to argue that it has no place, but it is to argue that it is a complicated question how to accept the views of people who are motivated by religion without making religion the sole basis for the public policy that is enacted. In addition, there are some in this movement who actually seem to view science as a threat to society itself. 1985, again, the former chair of the Council for Bioethics under President Bush, Dr. Leon Cass, writes, "Science essentially endangers society by endangering the supremacy of its ruling beliefs. Science, however much it contributes to health, wealth, and safety, is neither in spirit nor in manner friendly to the concerns of governance or the moral and civic education of human beings and citizens. Science fosters and encourages novelty. Political society, governed by the rule of law, cannot do without stability. Science rejects all authority save the truth. The political community requires trust in, submission to, and even reverence for its ruling beliefs and practices." This seems to me to be a very instructive statement about the nature of the fear of science. That is, that it does in fact facilitate wildly novel ways for people to organize their personal lives, their intimate relationships, their households, and they therefore create a tremendous amount of uncertainty about how we will organize our communities. And a very fundamental divide exists between those who think that it is important in order to achieve the good life for citizens and the good of the collective to try and direct the evolution of civil society, which may mean the control of science versus those who view the role of government as riding along on the wave, working hard to try and protect the vulnerable who are thrown up in the flotsam and jetsam, but nonetheless accepting that the evolution of civil society is, in fact, an adventure into the future. Now, I know that I'm beginning to run out of time, but I did want to talk briefly about one area where I think this divide is of potentially new significance in an area that has not yet been discussed as much as we might like. Because if, in fact, this new neoconservative approach to bioethics is in tension with the Enlightenment, if it's in tension with the very philosophy that helped to found the country, then it is a particular movement that, as the title of the talk would suggest, I've come to view as the Endarkenment. And the Endarkenment, for me, is a movement that tries to suppress the very research that would challenge our very most cherished notions of ourselves and our role in society and in the universe. Consider the words written by Galileo. And who can doubt that it will lead to the worst disorders when minds created free by God are compelled to submit slavishly to an outside will? When we are told to deny our senses and subject them to the whim of others? When people devoid of whatsoever competence are made judges over experts and are granted authority to treat them as they please? These are the novelties which are apt to bring about the ruin of commonwealths and the subversion of the state. Now, 2 weeks ago, the Vatican announced, a Catholic clergyman, who may or may not have clearly been speaking for the Vatican, announced that scientists, as well as others who in any way facilitate embryonic stem cell research, should be excommunicated. Galileo, of course, would not be surprised. After all, he was threatened with excommunication for merely endorsing the Copernican view that the Earth, and by extension humanity, is not the center of the universe. But at least the Vatican's actions are premised on the notion that the fertilized egg is the moral equivalent of the live-born baby or the Parkinson's patient, and that no one of those could be used for either of the other two. The secular opposition to things like cloning research tends to focus not on the sanctity of the embryo, but on the fundamental concern of social disruption and a debasement of our, quote, humanity. It's this kind of inchoate fear that I think is far more akin to the earlier efforts to stifle research by the Vatican back at the time that Galileo was writing. Now, we have had surprisingly little attention in the United States to the interaction between the First Amendment and scientific research. Beginning in the 1970s, there was a little attention. It started with a seminal article by Professor John Robertson from the University of Texas, raising the question, can scientific research be viewed as a form of protected speech? Now, the First Amendment doesn't only protect words. It also protects expressive conduct, the wearing of something that conveys a message. And the question then becomes, even if scientific research is not protected as a precursor to formal speech, can we ask if there are certain areas of science, subsets of science, that by their very nature, by the very question that is asked, are in fact a form of expressive conduct because they express the belief that something among our cultural norms can and should be challenged? Research on the origin of species, for example, conducted by Darwin, could be viewed as implicitly conveying a message, with that message being a rejection of extant religious and cultural views about the singularity of humans and a substitution of a worldview in which humans are just part of an animal continuum. Copernicus's own work was viewed by Goethe as having exactly this effect. Goethe wrote, "Of all discoveries and opinions, none may have exerted a greater effect on the human spirit than the doctrine of Copernicus. The world had scarcely become known as round and complete in itself when it was asked to waive the tremendous privilege of being the center of the universe. Never, perhaps, was a greater demand made on mankind, for by this admission, so many things vanished in mist and smoke. What became of our Eden, our world of innocence, piety, and poetry, the testimony of the senses, the conviction of a poetic, religious faith? No wonder his contemporaries did not wish to let all this go and offered every possible resistance to a doctrine which in its converts authorized and demanded a freedom of view and greatness of thought so far unknown, indeed not even dreamed of." We have today, in addition to the endless laboratory experiments done by high school students, none of which I would suggest have expressive speech value. We have, in addition, scientists who are looking to see how to replicate the very formation of life. Synthesizing cells, artificial chromosomes, somatic cell nuclear transfer, all of these challenge the very notion that life is something that is given by a force outside and greater than us, and also challenge the notion that there is necessarily a spark, call it a soul, that is needed before life becomes recognizable as similar to us. This kind of research, along with research that blurs species boundaries in the form of hybrids and chimeras, all represents a threat to what commentator Wesley Smith has called on his website human exceptionalism, which he contends is the bedrock of human rights, and what Cass has called the meaning of being human. And just yesterday we heard about the objections to transhumanism, or enhancement of our capabilities, again, as somehow taking away from the essential meaning of being human. But what if scientific research challenges the very notion that being human is in fact something special, as opposed to merely being lucky that we can talk and have buffet lunches, which my cat cannot, right? But that other than that, we need to look more closely at the particular differences between us and the cats and the gorillas and the trees in order to figure out what rights and duties should be ascribed to each of those species. Now, of course, bioethicists and legal experts would, of course, agree that even protected areas of human action, whether it's research, reproduction, or the press, nonetheless is subject to reasonable regulation. The point is reasonable. First, it requires that the regulation be narrowly tailored. Outright prohibitions are not permissible when regulation would suffice, whether it's to protect the health of women who might be egg donors, or it is to guard against the potential safety concerns in reproductive cloning. It also requires that when you argue for protection, that you argue for protection of entities who are legally entitled to protection. So that if the only argument against cloning research is that it creates and destroys embryos, and if embryos are, for the moment, and have been for 25 years, not legal persons under the Constitution, the argument that one could ban an otherwise protected form of research for the sake of these non-legal persons is weak in the extreme. In other words, if we accept the idea that research is protected, it means that we have to be cautious in our calls for prohibitions and tailored in our regulations with justifications that go beyond mere fear of science or fear of its social disruption. I'm just skipping ahead a little bit because I know that the time is running out. I'd like to conclude simply by saying that I think that bioethics discussions that actually try to tackle the political philosophies that underlie the analyses that we're doing would be enriched. We would know what we're arguing about. We would know we're arguing about libertarianism versus communitarianism, or we would know we're arguing about human essentialism versus non-human essentialism, rather than thinking that we're arguing about whether or not we can adequately regulate the potential abuses of assisted suicide or genetic screening or cloning for research. I also think it would be very helpful if we were more attentive to avoiding the temptation to conflate arguments about why a technology is bad or might lead to untoward consequences with arguments about calls for outright prohibition. And finally, and I had no time for this, much more attention to the role of the market and whether technologies are going to be widely disseminated or not, and if they are, to whom and how they might actually be used, so that our empirical speculations about future patterns of use would be far more accurate in order to undergird arguments about whether regulation is actually needed. But bottom line, from my own personal political perspective, very ideological, absolutely biased, it seems that the most important thing is that we begin to get a little bit more humble about the role of government in telling us how to live the good life. Those from the political left and the political right who are calling for increased attention to social control of science, in my opinion, would be well advised to consider the words of Thomas Jefferson: liberty is the great parent of science and of virtue, and a nation will be great in both in proportion as it is free. You know, we've had a lot of references to the Greeks today. Socrates apparently was a subversive, according to John Moreno. I would like to turn to a different Greek, and that is Aristotle, who wrote that man is naturally a political animal, and I would argue so too is the bioethicist. Thank you.